now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauk.
Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you to find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which you have always been and who you are. Very excited to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. As always, these broadcasts are dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. Rather unique integration, and is something that many people, especially in my beginning years of training, you know, I was taught to keep those two disciplines separate, that they simply do not go together. But that is not true, you know, and I find just whenever we integrate our spirituality and our mental health and our mental health issues, we find that they go together nicely. I am Dr. James Hauk, and if you would like more information about me, or perhaps you want to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Again, that's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to call in and be part of tonight's show, that number is toll-free. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Now, as I said, these broadcasts are podcasted, in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And these shows are now available for download on Audible and Amazon Music. And I'm happy to report that I'm in my fifth year with BBS Radio, and ever since day one, as I mentioned, that these broadcasts have always focused on the continued integration of our spirituality and our mental health. And I place this integration all within the context of our relationships, the relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationship that we have with others, and our relationship with God or the divine. And this integration of our spirituality and our mental health is very essential, because at any given moment, our minds interpret what we take in through our senses. I mean, that's what our minds do. And based on previous experiences and education levels and upbringing and so forth, our minds' interpretation often fail to capture a more accurate understanding of the deeper lessons and realities and greater truths. Now, the reason for this is because our egos, which are very self-centered and very limited, come in, they take over, and keep us from knowing ourselves as vast and eternal souls, as well as what needs to heal, so that we can live in forgiveness and gratitude and bliss and love on a daily basis. Now, admittedly, it is our ego that leads us astray with all kinds of thoughts and selfish pursuits. I mean, just sit with your ego sometime and let it talk to you, and hang on, because you'll be taken for a ride, because that's what our egos do. That just leads us to all kinds of thoughts and selfish pursuits. And it is a part of a lower level consciousness, if you will, which is often bound by a time, a space, a causation. And yet, we also need to pay attention to our egos by asking ourselves in any given situation, what in me has created this perception? Or what in me has created this reaction? Or what in me has created this distortion so that I can better understand where my healing and transformation are still needed. And this is the reason why the integration of spirituality and our mental health is vital for our awareness of who we are as souls. And here's a quick example, another good example here. There is a huge difference between what I would call worldly love, which is more familiar to us. And we kick around that word love all the time. You know, some people would say, well, I love chocolate, or I love her, or I love it when my team wins. We, you know, use that word interchangeably all the time. There's a huge difference between this kind of use of the word love and godly or the divine love. Now, according to my teacher and dear, dear friend, that we often use this term, I love you, but such love is conditional because it's temporary and it changes as it goes back and forth and back and forth of conflicting emotions of the mind, such as when it becomes envious or whenever it displays jealousy or even hatred. And yet, godly or divine love is a love that's not entangled in human emotions of the mind. Divine love is first and foremost eternal. It's not conditional and helps us to purify our minds by recognizing only that which is divine in all things. And this is really what reclaiming authenticity is all about. It actually can be summed up in one word, namaste, which when roughly, and I mean roughly translated, it means, because I see myself as a soul of light, this allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you are, even if you have yet to see it in yourself. Because, you know, it doesn't really matter who we are, where we were born, or into what family we were placed. You know, our world is just filled with relationships because we're social beings who often spend our lives trying to make sense of this world of ours. And we often try very hard to find our place in this world of ours. But as social beings, it's often within the context of these relationships that we experience tremendous pain and suffering. And these could be anything from acts of betrayal or cruelty that somebody has inflicted against us, or even vice versa. Maybe we've inflicted that against somebody else, or maybe just simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But many, many, many people, if not all, bear the scars of, say, a physical, a psychological, emotional, and or spiritual woundedness. So in this particular show, I'm going to be talking about basically how we integrate and how we transform our life stories, that is, from a place of woundedness or disappointment. And depending on how long we've been carrying around this brokenness, that also from a deeper place of bitterness, all of that, from a place of that woundedness to now a place of healing and authenticity and healthier relationships. And the difficulty then is often finding the courage to discover that which has always been in you, and in fact, finding the courage to discover who you have always been, who you are. Okay? Because, again, as I said from day one, I'm a firm believer that we come into the world with everything we need for ourselves and others. You know, things such as our gifts, our graces, or our skills, and especially our uniqueness. These are the things that we do come into the world with, or it's what the 14th century Scottish Franciscan described, John Duns Scotus, described as chaitas, or a thisness. And this is what I'd love to share with kids and teenagers, that you all have a thisness, kind of like a thumbprint. No two are alike. You know, you are unique in that aspect. So they're a chaitas, or they're thisness. Okay. But quite often, whatever we go through in this world, and maybe through other various experiences, we may have ended up giving away parts, if not the whole, of that uniqueness or that thisness. And maybe we've done this because perhaps we didn't feel as though we just simply could not live up to another person's expectations of us. And we tried and we tried and we tried and we just couldn't. But we never realized that another person's standards are never meant to be met. It's always shifting. It's always changing. It's always like, oh, nope, sorry, it's over here now. Or nope, I raised the bar higher. And if you really love me, if you really care, and if you're a good person, you'll be able to come up to my standard. And like I said, we keep trying and trying. And when we don't, we blame ourselves. When actually it's the person who sets the standards. It's never meant to be attained. And so we may have felt as though we didn't live up to another person's expectation of us. Or maybe we hid our uniqueness, our hachetas, from others in order to survive abuse that went on in the home, or abuse on, you know, in the workplace, or something of that nature. Perhaps those aspects of ourselves may have been taken away from us, or we didn't have the strength to fight that. We were too small. We were too young at the time. We didn't know any better. Well, either way, whenever we become aware that we have done these things, it does take tremendous courage to reclaim who we are. Because you see, those gifts, those graces, those strengths, that hachetas, that thisness, all belong to us, not anybody else. Or we can share them, but they belong to us. And so we can reclaim those things. We can reclaim our voice. We can reclaim our uniqueness or our thisness. And when this occurs, something rather unique happens. We soon discover that we begin to tell our stories, our life stories of transformation, from a different place in us, a place of healing and wholeness and gratitude. And, you know, it's no secret that we're going through some pretty difficult times out there in the world. And one of the aspects of suffering through either national tragedies or world tragedies and so forth is that it affects everybody, even down to the smallest towns and communities in our nation and throughout the world. And yet, with every loss we experience in our lives and every disappointment and every tragedy we're faced with, sooner or later, they all present us with this challenge. Will these experiences make me bitter? Or will these experiences make me better? And this is where I find, you know, where most people struggle between the two, being bitter or better. Many people ask me, so how does an experience have the potential to make me bitter or better? Well, let's flip that question around. You know, instead of a this or that kind of question, instead, how about we realize that there is so much more to us than what we have become so far? And again, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about, finding the courage to reclaim that which has always been in you from the beginning. So it does have the potential to make us better. And you see, this potential for us to become better is always there for us to realize and embrace and certainly to live in on a daily basis. Well, we'll be taking your calls in a little while, after the break, because I really want to hear from you on tonight's subject, walking a spiritual path. Walking a spiritual path. And I hear a lot of talk, you know, just down through the years, and I even this morning, heard many people talk about, you know, just how do you walk a spiritual path? What does that look like? How wide is it? And so forth. Well, we're going to get to all that, but I want us to begin focusing on a beloved Dr. Seuss book. I'm sure you've read this. It's, Oh, the Places You Will Go. It's a children's classic, and a lot of adults love it too, right? And of course, it was written by Dr. Seuss, and I think it was first published back in 1990, so it's fairly recent. And it was actually Dr. Seuss's last book to be published during his lifetime, right before his death. I think Dr. Seuss died at the age of 87, I believe. And interestingly enough, this book concerns the journey of life, as well as its challenges and its joys. So the story begins with the narrator, okay, and relating the decision of an unnamed protagonist, or let's just call him the reader, to leave town. And the reader travels through several geometrical and polychromatic landscapes and places, as somebody once had written, eventually encountering a place simply called the Waiting Place, which is ominously addressed as being a place where everybody is waiting for something to happen. And as the reader continues to explore, spurred on by the thoughts of places that she will visit and the things she will discover, the book cheerfully concludes with an open-ended ending. So here it is. Congratulations. Today is your day. You're off to great places. You're off and away. You have brains in your head. You have feet in your shoes. You can steer yourself in any direction you choose. You're on your own, and you know what to do. And you are the one who will decide where to go. You look up and down the streets. You look them over with care. And some of you will say, I don't choose to go there. With your head full of brains and shoes full of feet, you're too smart to go down any not-so-good street. And you may not find any you'll want to go down. In that case, of course, you'll head straight out of town. It's opener there in the wide open air. Out there, things can happen, and frequently do, as rainy and footsy as you. And then things start to happen, but don't worry, don't stew. Just go right along. You'll start happening too. Oh, the places you'll go. As I said, that book is just a classic children's book, and yet it has a powerful message for us adults. So certainly, walking a spiritual path is a common phrase in today's world. And yet, it means different things for different people. You know, sometimes it may mean that a person has undergone an awareness of something greater than oneself, let's say, and has decided to engage in the spiritual disciplines in order to discover deeper and hidden truths of the mysteries of life, right? Or still, others believe that walking a spiritual path is simply a code for selling all your possessions and moving to a distant land and helping the poor. Not bad. Okay. And a lot of times I would hear somebody remark that, well, to do something like that and to walk a spiritual path, that must take a lot of faith. Well, yeah, it does, if one is called to do this. Okay, but what if a person makes a mistake, or they realize someday that they wasted their life? Then what? Well, the main issue is not whether this person believes he or she wasted their life by wanting to help others. And perhaps the main issue is that the person found their life simply by reaching out to others in the first place. In fact, this person found their life's calling simply by having the courage to transcend their so-called limitations. And this is something that I run into time and time again when the subject of walking a spiritual path comes up in conversations. You know, there's always a little hint of hesitation, a little twinge of doubt, or a small amount of uncertainty. You see, it's almost as if a sense of fear takes over and could lock a person away in the furthest recesses of their minds, the place where it's cold and dark, but it's a familiar place. And this is why we can talk ourselves in and out of things all the time. You know, we can convince ourselves to do something, or we can convince ourselves not to do something. Again, this is where the mind comes in. Very tricky. Okay? And there's the ego. But even it's deeper than this. I mean, it really comes down to the assumptions about what we think about ourselves and others and God and how the world is supposed to work, according to what we think is best for us. Well, I remember a time when I fought what I thought was a very difficult spiritual path. Oh, I had a deep desire to minister to others, you know, and I still do. I just thought that I was going about it all the wrong way, and I didn't really know what to do. I would say that I was about 24 years old at the time, and I had been pursuing my calling to go into the ministry full time. And like all people who make it known that they will be doing some form of ministry in the future, one gets asked to help out in church or to make hospital calls, or at least fill in a Sunday school, you know, for a teacher who was sick. Anyway, I was kind of tapped on the shoulder and asked if I could lead an adult Sunday school group for several weeks. Okay. And I'll be the first one to admit that I had a long, long, long way to go. I mean, I would be standing up there and papers flying all over the place, stammering over my words. And from time to time, I would lose my place. And it seemed like week after week after week, I would go home with yet another Excedrin headache number 5. So, one night, I had a conversation with God. I said, okay, God, you and I have to talk. Look, I have been willing to pursue what I believe you put in my heart. And I'm even stepping out in faith by teaching others, but I really don't enjoy it. I really don't see the point. There's a lot more other people who are more qualified than I am. And furthermore, I just don't like it. So here's the deal. I will try one more time, and let's see what happens. Okay? Well, the next Sunday came around, and of course, I was up front teaching away, papers flying all over the place, stammering over my words, and losing my place from time to time. Well, finally, when the hour came to a close, mercifully came to a close, I quietly picked up my papers, stuffed them in my pack, and I quickly headed for my car. And I just hoped that nobody saw me. You know, now, no sooner had I unlocked my car and I was about to get in when a man came running up to me and he says, hey, hang on a second. I'm glad I caught you before you drove off. I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed that lesson. Nobody has ever explained that passage the way you did. It makes all sense now. And I've been trying to understand it for so long. Thank you very much. I just wanted to say just how much I appreciate you. Well, we shook hands, and I thanked him for his kind words. And I sat in my car for a long time, gently massaging my right temple, which was throbbing like it did each week. And then I had this awareness, a light bulb moment. And I finally, you know, I looked up and I said to God, okay, you're not going to let me out of this, are you? I guess it's not about me, is it? And that's when I heard my heart speak to me, and it said, you know, you're right. It's not about you. It's not even about what you can and can't do. But what it is, that it's all about what God can do in and through you. Will you at least trust me? And ladies and gentlemen, the rest is history. You see, having fears and doubts and uncertainty to a certain extent, it's normal. It's normal. After all, you know, we want to make sure that we do and say things correctly when we walk a spiritual path. at least we want to make sure that we're going in the right direction. And yet, perhaps, what if we would entertain, just for the sake of this evening, that being on a spiritual journey doesn't matter where we place our feet, because we can never fall off of our spiritual path. You know, it's not like we're walking a balance beam. Because how often do we imagine that being on a spiritual path means trying to walk on a literal footpath or a trail where we have to be careful where we step, or else we're going to fall off the path, or else we're going to go in a wrong direction? But what if, that's just for tonight, what if walking a spiritual path is more about paying attention to the lessons that are right in front of us all along the way? That it is more about the process rather than the end result. And again, just for tonight, let's also entertain, okay, that perhaps the entire purpose of walking a spiritual path is not for us to take a literal physical journey, but rather it involves us on a journey inward to ourselves. Well, I would, as I said, I would really love to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So again, if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Haupt. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Well, earlier in the show, that is the first half of the show, I started talking about the Dr. Seuss book, Oh, the Places You Will Go. And it was written in 1990, and the book concerns the journey of life, as well as its challenges and joys. And interestingly enough, unlike other Dr. Seuss books, this particular book is written in the second person language and uses the future tense, as in, oh, the places you will go. And very important to keep that in mind, you know, because when a lot of people start looking at the future, a lot of anxiety gets kicked up, and it's very difficult for people to stay in the present. But we can look to the future, but we do not need to be filled with anxiety over it, because we can stay in the present, as well as trust that, especially when we consider walking a spiritual path, that we're going to be okay. Okay. And so this particular story begins with a narrator, and he relates this decision of the reader, let's say, to leave town. And the reader finds herself journeying through several geometrical landscapes and places, and eventually finds herself in a place simply called the waiting place, which is described as a place where everybody is always waiting for something to happen. You've been there, I've been there. We all come to this place where we just need to wait. And as the reader continues to explore, he's spurred on by the thoughts of the places that she'll visit and the things that she will discover. And the book cheerfully concludes with what I would call an open-ended ending. That's kind of the point of the future. It's open-ended, but it doesn't mean that we need to be filled with anxiety. Yes. Now, ironically, you know, for us today, we can see a strong parallel between this book and the purpose of our spiritual journey, which always compels us to look inward. And this is also the main point of one of my favorite books. You're probably getting tired of me talking about The Alchemist, but it is a great, great book written by Paulo Coelho. And The Alchemist is where a young shepherd boy named Santiago sets off to find his personal legend or his destiny. Hello, another spiritual path, another spiritual journey. And his journey takes him across various lands to the pyramids in Egypt, because that is where he feels led. And that's where he encounters various people who are there at just the right time to help him along the way, to help him along this journey. Now, if you have ever read The Alchemist, you realize that Santiago's journey literally has brought him back to the place where he left. But he himself has been on an inward journey because he himself has been transformed along the way. I love that part about the book. That reminds me of a quote from T.S. Eliot, who once said that, let us not cease for exploration. And for all of our exploring will be for us to arrive at a place where we started, and we will know it for the very first time. You know, how's that possible? Because it's something about the exploration. It is something about the journey that is transformational. We are different. And you know, the prominent theme that runs through the book, that is The Alchemist, you know, and through the character Santiago, we often realize that when you really want something to happen in your life, the whole universe will conspire so that your wish comes true. In other words, we don't walk this spiritual journey alone. There will be people along the spiritual path that are there at just the right time to help us with whatever we need, exactly what we need. When you really want something to happen, the whole universe conspires so that your wish comes true. And it is this theme that ties into tonight's topic, because this is something I truly believe in, that whenever we start to pay attention to what has been placed on our hearts or has been placed in our hearts, and we hear the cry of our soul and we commit to it, the entire universe will make it happen if we remain open and teachable to every situation in our lives. And when we do this, we're also going to discover that we may have been destined to embrace the cry of our soul all along. In fact, when you look at it this way, it really takes the fear of failure out of the picture, doesn't it? Because you see, we often get tangled up in the belief that just because we cannot see a path clearly marked out for us, you know, with every step of the way, that all of our efforts will be for naught. I mean, we worry about making mistakes, or we worry about walking this path perfectly, because there are times when we want to avoid criticism, and we want to avoid ridicule, and we definitely want to avoid shame. And we have been conditioned to expect these reactions to continue because perhaps these have been attached to ourselves for so long. We're just not used to having things work out for us. But it's true, our spiritual path or our spiritual journey might be unknown to us, but it's not unknown to God. Because we assume that all of our efforts will be for naught, but why do we worry about not doing well Or why do we assume that whatever we undertake will turn out wrong? Is it this fear of failure? Or is it a fear of success? Because if we're honest with ourselves, I mean, really honest with ourselves, it just might be a little bit of both. Because either way, what fear does to us is that it keeps us immobile, whereby we do nothing. We don't say yes. We don't say no. In fact, we don't say anything at all. And I have to share with you, I deal with a lot of people so filled with fear that something will always go wrong, it will never work, or cause us anxiety over our assumptions. But if we were guaranteed success, would we be worried? No, we wouldn't. Kind of interesting. Sports figures often struggle with this too, you know, and ball players are notoriously superstitious, that they have all kinds of pre and post and even during the game rituals designed to quiet the voices of anxiety and fear and worry in their heads. In fact, many of them train their minds to see themselves being successful. Now, if you've been watching any of the Major League Baseball playoffs now, you know, just take a look at the players' behaviors. They're kind of funny when they come up to bat and they do all kinds of rituals quickly because we now have the pitch count. But if you ever, you know, are watching a live game at the stadium, you will not see pitchers step on the foul line. They'll jump right over it. Or once they get on the mound, they have like a ritual, or, you know, they take a few steps, or they, you know, take their gloves off and, you know, they just whatever calms them down, you know, so that they get ready to pitch the game or the next pitch. Now, a simple yet effective tool I often use with clients to help identify their underlying assumptions of fear and dread and avoidance is called the 15 Common Cognitive Distortions. And interestingly, this short assessment identifies ways that our mind convinces us of something that really isn't true. And these inaccurate thoughts are usually used to reinforce negative thinking or negative emotions. And we, you know, we tell ourselves things that sound rational and accurate, but really only serve to keep us from feeling bad about ourselves, you know. And cognitive distortions are really at the core of what many cognitive, behavioral, and other kinds of clinicians try to help a person learn in order to change in their therapy sessions. And by learning to correctly identify this kind of stinking thinking, person can then answer these negative thinkings, you know, just they have a reply. It's like, no, it's not that at all. They can refute it. And by refuting the negative thinking over and over and over again and developing a habit of refuting the negative thinking, it's slowly going to diminish over time and be automatically replaced by more rational, balanced, healthier thinking. And here's a few examples. You probably get a kick out of them and you will probably say, oh yeah, I've done that. Okay. First one is filtering. A person who engages in filtering or mental filtering takes all the negative details and magnifies those details while filtering out all the positive aspects of the situation. Okay, so certainly done this, you know. So for an example, let's say a person may pick out a single unpleasant detail and dwell on it just so exclusively that their vision of reality becomes darkened or distorted, okay? And this, I'm sure many people have used filtering. Like, say you get a job evaluation, okay? You're up for your yearly evaluation, and this means a raise if everything is going according to plan, and all good things and so forth. You get to keep your job and, you know, so on and so on. And let's say that on your evaluation, everything is stellar. You are doing a great job. However, there's one little area that the boss or the supervisor points out to you to say, you know what, You're a great employee. We just, you know, thank you, model. You're here on time. Everything's great. I wish I had been more like you. However, we feel that you need some work in this area. Okay, but you still get a positive review. You still get your raise, but you go home and you're focusing and dwelling on that one little area that needs work. And you start to beat yourself up. Well, I don't know why if I'm a great employee. I don't know if I'm a model employee because I, you know, why couldn't I figure out how to do this one area better? You know, I just can't believe that I, you know, didn't see that coming. You know, and over and over and over again, we just emotionally beat ourselves up. Well, that's filtering. You just filter out all the positive and you focus on the negative details. Another one of these cognitive distortions is polarized thinking, or we can just say it's black and white thinking, where in this kind of thinking, things are either black or white, or all or nothing. You know, we have to be perfect, or we're a complete and abject failure. And in this kind of thinking, there's no middle ground. And a person with polarized thinking places people or situations in this either or category with no shades of gray or allowing for the complexity of most people and most situations. So a person with this polarized thinking or black and white thinking sees only things as extremes. Okay, remember there's no gray area. Okay. Another example of a cognitive distortion is this overgeneralization. And in this particular distortion, a person comes to a general conclusion based on a single incident or a single piece of evidence. And so therefore, if something bad happens just once, they expect it to happen over and over and over again. So in other words, a person may see a single unpleasant event as a part of a never-ending pattern of defeat. Okay, so again, here's the example. Let's say a student gets a poor grade on one paper in a semester. And just because of that one poor grade, just that one poor grade, they conclude that, well, they believe they're a horrible student and that they should quit school. Okay, very similar to all or nothing thinking, but it's the overgeneralization that if something bad happens once, it's going to happen again and again and again. So you get a poor grade on a paper in one semester, you're going to keep getting poor grades on a paper. Okay, that's the difference. Another cognitive distortion is jumping to conclusions. And I know you out there, you're going to say, I've done this one a lot. And with jumping to conclusions, you know, without people saying so, a person who jumps to conclusions knows what another person, or they think, but they believe another person is feeling and thinking, and exactly why they act the way that they do. Big assumption in this one. So in a particular situation, a person is able to determine how others are feeling toward another person as though they could read their mind. And jumping to conclusions is also, could be manifest in itself as kind of like a fortune telling, where a person believes their entire future is already set in motion, whether it be school or work or even romantic relationships. Okay. So how many times have we been accused of jumping to conclusions that we assume something about a person, or we assume something about a situation, only to find out it's not the case. Okay, and let's see. Lastly, let's do one more. Catastrophizing. Okay, when a person engages in catastrophizing thinking, they expect disaster to strike, no matter what. And this is also referred to as magnification or magnifying, and can also come out of its opposite behavior. Minimizing. Okay. Now, in this particular distortion, a person hears about a problem and uses what if questions. So, for example, well, what if tragedy strikes? What if this happens to me? you know, almost like to imagine the worst absolute thing that's going to occur. And so a person might exaggerate the importance of insignificant events, such as their mistake or somebody else's achievement, or they may inappropriately shrink the magnitude of the significance or minimize the events. Like, well, okay, you got a raise at work. Okay, yeah, but you know, it was only like 2%. It's really no big deal. I wouldn't get all excited about that. You know, it's just minimizing. Okay. And again, they just keep minimizing until these events or these experiences appear very tiny, you know, such as a person's own desirable qualities, let's say, or maybe somebody else's imperfections. Okay. So what do these common cognitive distortions have to do with walking a spiritual path? Everything. Everything. And let's be honest here. How many times have we talked ourselves in and out of things, believing that we know what's best for us instead of trusting a process? I mean, remember, when we pay attention to what has been placed in our hearts, and when we hear the cry of our soul and we commit to it, the entire universe will make it happen if we remain open and teachable to every situation in our lives. And again, I can't overstate this enough, that whenever we do this, if we remain open and teachable, we're also going to discover that we're going to be able to embrace the cry of our soul. And this act of faith takes the fear of failure out of walking a spiritual path. Because following a spiritual path means that we have to be silent. We have to be open. We have to go inward to discover. We have to discover its own lessons and whatever else we need to be shown, designed to take us deeper into ourselves and ultimately bring us to the place of our soul's greatest desire. And that is to discover who we are. Who are we at our core? Because you see, by thinking this way, we realize that we never have to fear or worry about making a mistake, or that somehow we are displeasing to God. And we also have to stop worrying about whether or not others will understand what we do. It's not their spiritual path. They have their own to worry about, and they need to be responsible for themselves. So I also know a lot of people who try to explain their spiritual path to others, and they're just like, well, I don't get it. Okay, that's fine. Maybe you're not supposed to get it because it's not your path, you know, and vice versa. Okay. So lessons along the way, we need to be open to, we need to pay attention to, and a total surrender to God. Now, to quote Robert Frost in his book, The Road Less Traveled, sorry about that, tongue-tied, you know, he says, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled. And that made all the difference. Because when we're ready, the road appears. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. And being open and trusting does make all of the difference. Every life is sacred, and therefore every spiritual path is also very sacred. Well, I want to leave you tonight with a special contemporary covenant prayer that I have found in the Wesleyan tradition. It is very beautiful. It's also open-ended. It's filled with trust. It's filled with faith. It's filled with, I don't have to worry about whether or not I'm going to be pleasing or not pleasing to God. I'm not going to worry about whether or not I, you know, I'm going to fail or succeed, because it has nothing to do with that. In the Wesleyan tradition, this special contemporary covenant prayer goes like this. I am no longer my own, but I am yours. Put me to what you will. Place me with whom you will. put me to doing, put me to suffering. Let me be put to work for you or set aside for you. Let me be praised for you or criticized for you. Let me be full. Let me be empty. Let me have all things. Let me have nothing. I freely and fully surrender all things to your glory and service. And now, O wonderful and holy God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer, you are mine, and I am yours. So be it. And the covenant which I have made on earth, let it also be made in heaven. Amen. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I hope that this broadcast has brought some light into your life and light and understanding of how to walk a spiritual path. Remember, we each walk our own spiritual path. Do not compare yourself to others because everybody's path is different. But the aspect of being open, aspect of being silent, the aspect of going inward to discover leads us into a deeper and deeper journey of who we are and whose we are. Until next time, everybody take care, be safe, and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck. It's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.